From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. When people think of activism, sit-ins, marches, and rallies often come to mind. Atlanta choreographer and dancer Rayanna Brown has another spin. In 2016, a video of her kneeling during a college football game went viral. Back then, she was a 22-year-old member of the Gold Rush dance team at Georgia Tech. Now Brown is considering her advocacy with movement. Her new dance production, Skid, has an underlying message and begins in Atlanta this weekend, and she's joining us in the studio. Rayanna, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for being here.
Of course.
So Skid opens this weekend in Atlanta. What is the production about?
So Skid is a celebration of Atlanta culture, but we're doing so through the lens of looking at homelessness and gentrification within the city. So those issues are very heavy, and a lot of people are like, oh, the show is going to be really sad. But I decided to look more at the resilience and the strength of humanity that's kind of reflected in those ideas. So the premise behind the show is we're looking at I've always been fascinated with this idea of the dehumanization of different groups of people and how that affects not only the people that are being marginalized, but also the people who are doing the marginalization.
So the way that we can walk past a homeless person
exactly,
in the street.
Exactly. And how that can carry over to different marginalized groups. So it's not just a one-sided story, but we're specifically focused on homelessness and gentrification in Atlanta. And it's the idea of combating this myth of the monolith, which is this assumption that we place on a lot of marginalized people that they are one-sided or that they're only defined by their financial situation, their race, their sexuality, their religion, what have you. And that allows us to classify them as other. So the whole goal of the show is to show the humanity that is within people that we often classify as other and how we're actually a lot more similar than we may think, and that strength that is required to exist within these like very harsh conditions. So that's kind of the idea of the show.
And they're big ideas. So how do you begin to approach that as a choreographer with movement?
Yes. So I do a lot of research. My room is full of sticky notes and lots of books that I've highlighted. But I try to make sure that my work is always extremely authentic. So often you'll hear me in rehearsal saying, like, does it make sense? Does this go along with what I'm really trying to say? And so for this particular show, I've done a lot of research within James Baldwin's work and also Gordon Parks' like photography and his work that he did for the civil rights movement. And just kind of looking at the way that they are able to show humanity and show the strength of a people through images and through words. And that's kind of where I get a lot of my inspiration. I'm also from Atlanta, so my city inspires me a lot. Mm-hmm. And the music of the city and just kind of the culture of the city, it's very vibrant, even though there is a lot of like bad stuff going on at the same time. There's this strength that's kind of underlying it. So that's kind of where it all comes from. And then as far as the movement, I do something I call brain mapping, where I'll start with a central idea. So for this show, the central idea started with the word skid. And then I kind of branch off from that until I reach movement ideas. So there's different hand gestures that we do. The dancers have a move where our heads are pulled all the way back and our arms are pulled back. But that all originated from this original idea of skids. So that way I can make sure that once I get to the movement, it's coming from an authentic place based on all the research that I've done and based on the images and the actual subject matter that I'm working with.
Your previous show, Inhuman, also was inspired from literature,
yes,
in part of Toni Morrison and the art of Jean-Michel Basquiat. So
yes,
visual too. So you're incorporating a lot of different ideas together. Are you doing this with a full company? How many dancers are there?
I have a lot of dancers. I have 29 dancers.
That's a lot.
That includes myself. I also dance in some pieces in the show. But yes, it is a lot of people.
So what kind of styles are in the performance? What kind of dance styles?
So I always say that it's kind of my base of my soup would be contemporary ballet and modern, but it's got a little bit of everything. I trained at Price Performing Arts Center when I was younger, and we did everything, and so it's very clear to me that all of my training when I was younger is very apparent in my work. So this show, There's Horton technique. There's a little bit of Graham, a lot of house footwork, a lot of crumping, hip hop style movement. And in this one, I also started, I've been fascinated with whacking and disco. One of my teachers started to teach me like whacking movement.
I'm really you're going to have to tell that. This old lady what whacking is.
So do you know what voguing is? Voguing
yes,
is
yes. Okay,
so
when you sort of strike a pose yes. like a model or, you know, very exaggerated.
Exactly. So whacking is, to me, I guess the best way to describe it would be it's a more fluid version of that. It's got a lot more hand gestures that are constantly moving through space. And I found that to be a really good fit for this show because I feel like when you're trying to define things as complex as humanity, it doesn't feel right to me to use something that feels stagnant or feels stuck. And so whacking kind of gives this expression to it that I felt like we really needed in this show. So there's a lot of that. What else is there? There is...
That's enough for me.
Okay.
I mean, that's all.
Oh, and
West
African dancing. So a little bit of everything so that, you know, everyone has something that if you only like West African dancing, there's a little bit in there for you as well. If you only like ballet, there's that as well. So
you're incorporating all of these other dance traditions mm-hmm. as well as a sort of oral tradition, a pictorial tradition, mm-hmm. and a story tradition. Are you telling a story when you're doing it?
Yes. And so for this show, it was a little more difficult, I think, than my last show. The last show, we kind of did like a snapshot idea. So we just kind of jumped around to a lot of different storylines, and it didn't necessarily all have a throughout storyline. But for this one, what we're doing is there's a love story that's kind of going throughout the whole show. But what's important is actually the surroundings of the love story, which is where you see everyone else's story. And I'm trying something new where each of my cast members, I gave them a specific character and kind of the environment that they live in. So some of them are people who are experiencing homelessness. Some of them are people who are trying to like just carve out a space for themselves in the world and they feel like they're being pushed to the side. Others don't know anything about what's going on. But and by doing that, I didn't give them storylines like this is where you start and this is where you end. I just told them, okay, now look at the pieces that you're in. You know the intent of the pieces. You know your character. What is your character's story? So today we're actually talking about that as a cast. How each of our individual characters start and how they end in the show. So I'm trying something new. We'll see how it works out. But we're trying to create these more organic interactions on stage because I feel like when you're coming from an authentic, more organic place, people can relate to it more and are able to take in the message more than it feeling so surface level.
Mm-hmm. Not just a performance,
exactly,
so to speak.
Exactly.
That's Rihanna Brown. She is a dancer. She's a choreographer. And as you can hear, in charge of a big production beginning this weekend, yes. It is called Skid. Well, let's get back to, you know, messages. You know,
yes.
You're talking about the message of resiliency in this production, but there was a big message that you sent back in your Georgia Tech days, kneeling during the national anthem. This was after the San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick started the trend. He said it was to protest the treatment of minorities in the U.S. What were you going for with that gesture?
That would be the same thing that I was going for, definitely. And I think my real goal was to bring attention to that issue on Georgia Tech's campus. Sometimes at Georgia Tech, because the school is so hard and we have so much going on, a lot of these issues weren't being addressed at a wide campus level, but as a Black student on campus, and I think I was African American Student Union president at the time that I kneeled, so a lot of the other Black students were kind of expressing the same concern that as an institution, we weren't feeling supported. And then after Terrence Crutcher was killed, for me that was kind of, I just couldn't take it anymore, like not feeling supported by my school in the sense of those issues being talked about and like people knowing what was going on in the country and how students on campus were feeling like how heavy things were for us at the time, in addition to going to Georgia Tech, which is a very hard school.
In fact, we're going to be talking about that in the next segment, like the mental health issues that are raised at Georgia Tech and other colleges.
Definitely.
How about, did you get support from your team and your fellow classmates? Because
yes.
As you said, it's, you know, kind of divided there.
Yeah, no, I definitely did. And I actually had to leave the team in the spring because I had to get hip surgery that year. And a lot of people think I got kicked off the team or anything like that. But that wasn't the case. The school actually was really supportive as well. When I was on the team, they did a really great job of keeping any like backlash from getting to me. And my teammates were supportive. And I always tell people that I don't feel like any animosity towards my teammates either for not kneeling. I believe that when you are in a social justice movement or in a civil rights movement, you need the full spectrum of people to participate, but not all in the same way. So I like to be on the forefront of things, and I'm very out and loud about my activism. But I think you also need the people who are more quiet and behind the scenes with their activism. And that I don't hold that against them at all. You need all of those people and all of those voices to be involved. And the main goal of it was just to get people talking about what was going on in the country. And hopefully that worked out.
Well, and people certainly have been talking about it. Kaepernick started kneeling about 3 years ago. Since then, it expanded.
Yeah.
Some people now boycott the NFL because of it. Others burn Nike gear after they gave him an endorsement deal or expressed outrage online. So, you know, looking at this, I love your approach, the idea that people can do what they want to. So it's not for you seen as a lack of support for your thinking, your cause, if they don't choose to do it the same way?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think that my main goal, especially, like, same thing with my choreography, and kind of that's how my company is named. So Komanse is the name of my company, Komanse Dance Theater, and Komanse means the beginning. And so my whole goal is to be the beginning of a lot of these conversations with my choreography or with kneeling or with we've done a silent protest on Georgia Tech's campus before as the African American Student Union. To start these conversations, whether you get upset or not, it's going to require you to at least take a second and be like, well, why am I upset? Hopefully that's the goal. Why am I upset? Or why do I feel like I should support this? And so those conversations at least are in your head somewhere, whereas before, maybe you were just able to ignore these people or ignore what's going on. So the response to me is less important as the conversations. I feel like once you get the conversation started, you're kind of going to have to deal with it, whether the way you deal with it is choose to ignore it. That's more of a conscious decision instead of just being oblivious to what's going on.
Well, there was a big conversation a couple of years ago when 3 years ago when Beyonce used her platform at the halftime of the Super Bowl to raise awareness about police brutality. Mm-hmm. Of course, we do have a big game coming up here in Atlanta in just a couple weeks. Her performance was met with criticism, threats, boycotts of her music. And of course, you know, like we saw the Dixie Chicks shut up and sing. How do you respond to those who say performers should just stick to dancing and not worry about politics and social justice?
For me, just in my opinion and my work, I like to create work that means something, and I'm very much so like a protest Patty. That's what my friends call me.
What does that mean?
That I'm very into social activism, and I don't have a problem like being like standing up to what's going on. And my work definitely reflects that. But that isn't to say that there shouldn't be work where it is just focused more on just the aspect of dancing. But that's just not me. And I wouldn't feel like I'm being authentic to myself and my work if I was to create something that didn't mean anything. Yeah, so I really liked Beyonce's performance, but I love Beyonce. So definitely a little biased.
Okay, so upcoming production of Skid this weekend. Mm-hmm. Quickly, we got a wrap. Person listening to this interview who may not be able to make it, what message do you want to send to them?
Oh, that's hard. I would say our biggest thing that we should focus on as a people across the entire world is really looking at how we treat others and if we can see, if we're allowing ourselves to see their humanity. Because I feel like once you allow yourself to do that, empathy, kindness, all of these things will come through. So if you just don't classify people as other.
Choreographer and activist Rihanna Brown, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Her new production Skid opens this weekend at the First Center for the Arts at Georgia Tech. And you're listening to one of the featured songs, Miss Jackson by Outkast. This is On Second Thought. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Amid the stress of college finals last semester, two Georgia Tech students took their own lives. National data indicate the problem is not unique to one school. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among college students. About 1 in 12 students has a suicide plan, according to the National College Health Assessment. Georgia Tech has been working to address mental health concerns on campus and has been allocating millions of dollars to expand resources. Third-year student Colin Spencer has worked on those efforts as director of the Mental Health Student Coalition, and he's joining us in the studio. Colin, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I'm curious what led you to be involved in mental health advocacy at Georgia Tech.
So I came in as a freshman, and I had my own sort of struggle with mental health, and I was initially stigmatized against resources and getting help, but once I did and I got better, I was like, why did it take me so long to get help whenever I needed it? And things just kind of built from there.
Did you have any signs of depression when you were in high school or earlier in your life?
A little bit, but they weren't sort of particularly pronounced or affected my daily functioning until I got to college.
Mm-hmm. And depression is estimated to affect approximately 40% of college students nationwide. That's, again, the National College Health Assessment figures there. So what kind of resources are available to students at Georgia Tech struggling with depression, other mental health problems, especially given that stigma?
There are sort of three major resources. So the first is the Counseling Center, which sort of provides your typical therapy, different forms of therapy. We also have psychiatric services as well, which is sort of the more medicinal side of it. And then both of those resources also offer referrals to outside communities. And so they're able to match students with insurance providers for long-term care.
Mm-hmm. So is that something you would have to approach, or would maybe an RA or teacher recommend that you take advantage of some of these services?
I think it really just sort of comes on a case-by-case basis. Any student's able to just sort of walk in and schedule an appointment. But, you know, if someone sees you in need and struggling, specifically with mental health problems, then they may recommend you go there, but they're not going to sort of force you into it.
Right. And you, Colin, wrote an op-ed for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and said, college is a breeding ground for trauma and stress, and that at Georgia Tech, most of your peers, quote, have had at least one class where academic rigor borders on cruelty. So what do you mean? What's the standard there?
I think what ends up happening is, you know, from a faculty perspective, their real focus is to do research, and teaching sort of comes second to that. And as a result of that, you know, grading schemes can change in the middle of the semester, or syllabi may not adequately affect the course load of students. And so there's a disconnect in communication, which ultimately fosters real stress for students who meet changing expectations constantly.
And this counters the narrative that I think I've heard a lot of recently, that college professors often go very easy on students because they're dealing with helicopter parents who don't like them to get a bad grade. How do these two reconcile?
It's hard to sort of generalize anything to the entire academic community. And there are, I think, two different approaches where a teacher may, because of their workload, make things easier, but they may inadvertently make things much harder. And I think we see much more of the latter at Georgia Tech in some of the more difficult classes.
What do you mean by the changing schemes, grading schemes?
There have been some cases that I've heard from my peers where, you know, you'll say in your homework assignments are worth 20%, but then you sort of find out in the middle semester, oh no, they're actually worth 30%, or, you know, we're going to curve the test this way, but then sort of everyone ends up failing the test, so then they have to curve it a different way. And so there's not sort of a unique set of expectations that don't change.
You also wrote that workaholism and lack of sleep have just been normalized, and that people treat those unhealthy habits like badges of pride. What kind of pressure does that create for students like you?
Yeah, so I think at Georgia Tech, we're in a very high-pressure environment, which sort of fosters real loss in social status and reputation among students, faculty, and administration. And because we all sort of experience that stress, that despair, we also share it together.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this expression that students use at Georgia Tech, that they don't graduate, they get out.
Right.
So what's the message to younger students who are just starting out? That's not of hope.
Right. So I think they come in with sort of a very idyllic image of Georgia Tech, and that slowly changes over time, sort of depending on the experiences they have. But I think coming in and having this sense of get out is a real problem. It's something that people have been discussing widely on campus, especially fairly recently at different levels.
So they just got to grind through it kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, is an elite school, sleep deprivation and all-nighters seem to be par for the course. Is this a norm at any other high-ranked schools?
So I can't sort of speak from my personal experience, but, you know, looking at the data from, you know, the National Center or for mental health, or looking at UPenn's data set, looking at all different colleges across the United States, this sort of sense of stress and this overall poor culture whenever it comes to self-care seems to be ubiquitous across the board, especially at more quote-unquote elite higher education institutions.
And this is not the first time Georgia Tech has drawn media attention for a student death. In 2017, the police-involved shooting death of Tech student Scout Schultz sparked protests about mental health needs on campus. How did administration respond then, and what kind of progress has been made?
Right. So immediately following the shooting of Scout, two major developments happened. Three, actually. So the first was the establishment of the 2017 action team. So three action teams were established by President Peterson to collect recommendations on what to do next. So those are still being implemented right now. Second of all, me, some other student leaders, as well as administration, worked together to establish $1 million fund for mental health initiatives. Now, I currently oversee the allocation of those funds as chair of the Joint Allocations Committee. And so we allocate new funding to innovative and evidence-based mental health proposals from departments and individuals on campus.
It's a huge responsibility.
Right.
And for you, you know, you're a third-year student, presume one more year left at Tech. What kind of changes have you made in your life and that you'd like to see others create before your time at Tech comes to an end?
Yeah, so really what I've been focusing on for basically the past year and a half almost is the Intercollegiate Mental Health Conference, which I mentioned in my article. And what we found is that there's a lack of an evidence base for us to advocate for change as students. If we don't know what is out there and what's been proven to work, it's hard for us to advocate for change and then for administration to enact that. And so the conference is essentially focused on developing and sharing those best practices. And so the next step is then to be implementing those afterwards.
And evidence-based in this case are what? Medication, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or other kind of therapies?
No, so we're looking more at sort of institutional policies and programs such as, peer support groups or temporary stipends for students who have low income and suddenly fall into poor financial situations, things similar to that.
So, Colin, talk for a moment for a person who's listening to this interview who may be in need of help, may, like you, have felt, I don't want to draw attention to myself. This isn't that bad. I can shake it off. What is your message to that person?
It is okay to not feel okay. And that even if you don't see it, there are people out there who love you. You know, there is this perceived stigma that exists, but a lot of the times your peers do care about you. And so reach out to people in your community who you trust, and they'll be supportive and get you to where you need to be.
Well, Colin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you as well.
Georgia Tech student Colin Spencer, he leads the Mental Health Student Coalition. And if you or somebody needs help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's toll-free number is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. The participation of students like Colin is critical to Georgia Tech's campus mental health strategy. Given the national scope of the issue, we dug around for other successful models and practitioners in the collegiate mental health field. Barry Schreier is director of the University Counseling Service at the University of Iowa and Communications Committee Chair at the Association of University and College Counseling Center Directors. He joins us now on the line from Iowa City. And Barry, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Colin just told us that the academic culture on his campus is hyper-stressful. So yeah. From the perspective of someone giving care to students, what kind of stressors are we seeing in kids?
Yep. So we, for the Association of University and College Counseling Center Directors, we survey our membership every year. So this is the largest organization of campus mental health leaders in the world. And each year, out of our 900-plus members, over 600 will complete this survey. So it's a really comprehensive survey of what are the presenting concerns and what is what we call distress looking like on campus. And so for this year, as it is with every year, anxiety is the highest ranking reason why students are coming in for counseling, followed quickly by depression. And when we say anxiety, we're not talking about nervous about my test tomorrow. We're talking typically about longer standing, perhaps more chronic diagnosable anxiety. And depression, not meaning like having a down day, but again, probably longer standing, more chronic diagnosable depression. And those two diagnoses account for over half of the reasons why students come to the counseling services.
Well, a lot of people who listen could be thinking, you know, I pulled all-nighters in college, you know, this is a stressful time. So are students really more stressed out than ever before? As you've been taking this survey of college counseling centers, have you seen a jump?
We have seen a jump. For instance, one of the factors that we discovered is that factors such as previous counseling, thoughts of harm to self, suicidal ideation, all have continued to grow in terms of students presenting for counseling at campuses. All those indices have continued to grow over the last 4 to 5 years. And so we are seeing an increase in those presenting concerns. It leads to the question of, like, why is this going on?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are students more mentally ill than they ever have been before? And the research is not clear on that. Right?
Well,
we can't.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, sure. So we can't clearly state, we look at these factors. These factors are clearly leading to the fact that students are more mentally ill. What we are aware of is two critical factors. One is that students are certainly more distressed. They certainly present with much more levels of distress. And whether that translates into diagnosable mental illness is not entirely clear. But students clearly are presenting with much higher levels of distress than they've ever had. And some of the speculation about why that might be is, one, they are a generation that is exposed to everything all the time, everywhere. And so when I was a college student, you know, and I was pulling my all-nighters, I wasn't exposed to everything going on in the world all the time. I got 30 minutes of news a day, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And these students are exposed to everything, everywhere, all the time. That's combined with one of the things we know about this generation is it's not a generation that regulates its own emotions very well. They have a lot of strength. It's a very strong generation. And talking to the young man from Georgia Tech that you just spoke to is a clear indicator of the strengths of this generation. But one of the strengths that this generation doesn't have is self-regulation. This generation just doesn't regulate its own emotions very well. And so that combined with a lot of distressful exposure can create the presence of anxiety, depression, etc.
Mm-hmm. And what is the connection between those mitigating or temporary or even sustained events of anxiety and depression and larger mental health issues and concerns?
So what is the outcome of those sorts of things?
Yes.
Yeah, so what we do, again, and the gentleman from Georgia Tech talked about the studies at Penn State. So the studies at Penn State that he was talking about is a thing called the Center for Collegiate Mental Health, and it's run out of Penn State. They put out a report every year, and it comes from a couple hundred colleges uploading data from their counseling centers to this database. So last year's database took a look at 179,964 unique college students presenting for mental health services on campuses. So it's an enormous database. And what we know is this, is that the self-reported lifetime prevalence of threat of self, so this is non-suicidal self-injury, is up for 4 years in a row.
Mm.
And so the presence of ongoing anxiety and depression has critical outcomes for our students in terms of self-harm ideation and including also thoughts of and threats to others.
Right. And suicide is the second leading cause of death among college students. I want to talk about threats to others because we do talk a lot about, you know, anxiety and depression manifesting. But there are bigger, you know, we do know some high-profile cases of psychoses and violent sociopathic behavior. I think of Virginia Tech, Santa Monica, mass shootings come to mind. How do you consider those cases and identifying potential perpetrators when it comes to mental health on campus?
You know, that's a really critical question, and it's outside my area of expertise. I think there are folks on every single campus anymore these days who make their expertise area in the idea of threat assessment and threat management. What they will say broadly is that mental health and diagnosable mental illness is not necessarily an indicator of threat of harm to others.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, typically people who have diagnosable mental illness are unequivocally much more the victims of violence than they're ever going to be the perpetrators of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have 10 students with long-term chronic depression, while one of those students might act out and engage in violence acts, nine of them won't.
Are there any models in the system of innovations on taking care of mental illness, or at least monitoring it, you know, involving RAs, involving educators, in helping to identify kids who might have trouble?
Yeah, great question. So campuses are being exceedingly proactive in terms of responding to the prevalence of mental health concerns. So in the survey this past year from the Association of University and College Counseling Centers, we asked, at your center, have you gained staff? And so last year, 35% of centers surveyed said that they gained staff positions. And on average, it was almost 8 staff positions. Mm-hmm. So counseling centers and campuses are really beefing up in a lot, in sort of ways we've not ever seen historically, and adding staff to their counseling centers to meet the demand. So that's one thing counseling centers are doing and campuses are doing. The other thing that we're seeing proliferate, which is really very creative, is what we call our embedded models.
Mm-hmm.
And these are models where people are, mental health professionals are being hired by the counseling center and being placed in other areas of campus outside of the counseling service. And so you might see staff, therapists in the residence halls, and that's permanently where they are, is in a residence hall, serving residence hall students.
Barry, I'm going to ask you to hold on right there. We want you to continue over the break, but we just have to take a quick break. This is On Second Thought. We're talking about some new models and ways of dealing with campus mental health issues. Again, we'll be back in just a minute. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Mental health concerns are a big issue in our society at large and on college campuses. 2 Georgia Tech students took their own lives just before final exams last semester. Well, I'm speaking about some of the approaches to dealing with mental health on campus with Barry Schreier. He's director of the University Counseling Service at the University of Iowa, and he also holds a leadership position at the University Association of University and College Counseling Center Directors. Want to pick up there, Barry. We talked earlier with Colin about how he was involved in campus, in dealing with mental health on campus. And you talked about how some campuses are placing people who can help, counselors, inside of residence halls, inside of places where students interact. Do you want to pick up on any of that?
Sure. Yeah. Again, it's a proliferating model. We asked members of our association last year, how many of you are doing this? And over 1 in 10 campuses had embedded positions, and 5 years ago there weren't any. And so we're seeing a huge proliferation, and it can include places like residence halls, athletics, professional or graduate colleges, et cetera, et cetera. And so we are seeing a proliferation of that, and it's to increase accessibility, to serve typically underserved populations, and to provide specialized services to our campus, like in sports psychology.
Mm-hmm. So that is bringing help to where the students are interacting. But we've also seen dramatic increase in depression among college students being reported, including one study that shows 40% of students say they feel depressed. That's up 8% from a few years ago. Yep. But also reporting that the percentage of students thinking about and actually attempting suicide have gone up. Do you think, looking at the system as a whole, are students just reporting the need for help more, or is it really a dramatically worsening problem?
It's an outstanding question, and one we're still working to figure out. And you lay your finger on 2 of the critical issues. Is one, is this just something that it's up overall? Is it the way we're asking the questions of students? And is it just perhaps we're suffering the problems of our success, which is we've done such a good job reducing stigma and normalizing the seeking of mental health services that we're just seeing a larger influx of students overall seeking and reporting these things? Hard to know just yet, but we do know it's up, and we're trying to figure out why that is.
Well, and as we mentioned, 2 Georgia Tech students took their own lives just before final exams, within days of each other. What about the phenomenon of copycat events in students who use suicide as a way of ending their life? Can these events trigger that?
Yeah, so one of the phenomenons we're aware of is what we call suicide contagion. And it's not unusual for us to see a suicide on a campus and then see a second and even a third, sometimes a fourth or more, depending on the campus and the situation. So yes, contagion is a critical concern for campuses when we sadly and unfortunately sustain a suicide on our campus.
You mentioned earlier that this is a generation of kids who have great strengths, but also carry a lot of distress. in their life growing up, they've got information coming at them from all kinds of different directions. This is also a time of unsupervised behavior. Traditionally, when you get to college, alcohol use, drug use, both prescribed and off-label, and the phenomenon on college campuses, especially of using Adderall and other brain boosters for studying. Any connection there are you and your colleagues seeing between drug use and possible depression or anxiety and even suicidal ideation?
Yeah, so they do run it hand in hand, and we do ask students about their alcohol and drug use. In terms of the correlation, we certainly do see a correlation between alcohol and drug use and presenting mental health concerns.
How about antidepressants? There's a lot of research on the effects of how antidepressants affect developing brains. I think you can, no matter, depending on where you stand, you can look at evidence pro and con.
Absolutely. I was looking at the data from the Center for Collegiate Mental Health, which I reported about earlier, and we asked students when they come for counseling, you know, do you feel like drug and alcohol is a problem for you? And the numbers have mostly hovered pretty similarly and in some ways have fallen across the last few years. So we asked students questions like, have you ever felt the need to reduce your alcohol or drug use? And it has hovered in sort of the low 20%. It peaked about 4 years ago and has fallen a couple percent in the last couple of years. And so that indicates to me that we are seeing campuses, and the University of Iowa is no exception, doing a lot of proactive work on their campuses to reduce drug and alcohol binge as well as prescription medication binging.
Mm-hmm. How about the number of students who are seeking help? There's a great increase, as we heard from Colin earlier, encouraging other people to seek help if they're having trouble. Does that increase in students seeking help tell us, you know, positive signs, students feel empowered to get the help that they need? Or does this just point back to an increase in mental health issues on college campuses?
I'm glad you asked that question, because often stories are really turned only towards, you know, the problems of this generation of students. And some of the things that we also know about this generation of students is, A, they're very civically minded, they're very civically engaged, which is a critical strength of this generation. But they also, again, have they seek mental health services. They don't have the stigma. And again, stigma is not one size fits all for every community. But they overall will seek mental health services in numbers that we've never seen them use before. In surveying our counseling centers, over half the students that are seeking counseling at a college have had counseling prior to coming to college.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will have a history of that. The other thing we know is, on average, when a student comes for counseling, they're only going to come between 4 and 5 times for individual counseling, and then they're done.
Is that enough?
For a majority of students, it is. The number one number of sessions that students use when they come to a counseling center, the number one is one session.
Mm.
So the far majority of students are going to come to the counseling center once.
Mm.
And so when we see high-level usage, we know for a fact, looking at data, that about 20% of the students use about 50% of the service.
We have to wrap in just a moment, but wondering if colleges and universities are able to keep up with this increased demand for counseling services.
It tends to feel a little bottomless.
Mm.
And so you mentioned, which I think is a really nice mention, is that campuses are doing a lot of great work in basically helping the whole community respond, so that the counseling center is not the hammer for every mental health nail. And so this can then turn into things like giant campus-wide mental health fairs, so that we're creating awareness, training staff and faculty so they can be first-line responders when they see students in distress, because students often only want to talk to the people they know. And so helping staff, faculty, fellow students, RAs, be responsive to students when they see distress and act as preventively as possible so we can keep mental health concerns at the lowest rates we can.
Barry Schreier, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for the call.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Michael Coles took an $8,000 investment and turned it into the $100 million Great American Cookie Company. But he survived some knocks and a life-threatening car crash along the way. We're going to talk with him about getting back into the saddle, in his case, on a racing bike. Be sure to join us for that tomorrow or catch it on the On Second Thought podcast. You can find it at your favorite podcast purveyor. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court granted the Trump administration's request for a transgender military ban, for now. It will temporarily allow the Pentagon to bar transgender people from joining or remaining in the military. The justices will allow the ban to go forward while appeals are heard in lower courts. President Trump initially announced the ban on Twitter in 2017. That took transgender activist Monica Helms by surprise and prompted this response from the Marietta veteran and creator of the transgender pride flag.
I pushed around 16 nuclear missiles in the Atlantic Ocean to keep the Russians from blowing us up. And I protected the rights of every American when I was in the military. And I don't seem to get all those rights. There's something wrong with that. My name is Monica Helms, and I'm a transgender activist. I served in the military from 1970 to 1978, and I didn't realize that I was different until the middle of my term in service. And I had to keep it a very strong secret because I knew how they reacted to these kinds of things. I kept all my girl things in my van when I was serving. That way I didn't have anything with me when I was on board the submarine, so I didn't have to worry about anybody finding out. I was very proud of serving in the military, and especially on submarines. My family comes with a very long history of military people. I have uncles that served during the war. My father served in three branches of service and in three wars. My grandfather served in the Navy. My son was a Marine. My brother was an Army person, and his son is an Air Force person at this time. So I have a long history of military service, and I wanted to honorably serve. And so I did not want to leave the Navy until my time was up. The morning that President Trump tweeted about kicking transgender people out of the military, it was just horrible to see the president say such things that we were not worthy in his eyes to serve our country, and yet many of us have served, and many of us are serving openly today. The president is just throwing out a lot of BS when it comes to the money involved in transgender people. First of all, there's not a heck of a lot of us in the military. And second of all, not every one of them is going to want any kind of transitioning services. Many of the people serving today have already transitioned. There's an estimate that 400 women served as men in the Civil War for both sides. We have people who have been from corporals all the way up to colonels and generals, and they have served honorably, some with high security clearances, and many of the friends that I have served 20 years in the military, coming out with an honorable discharge. So there is a lot of people. The history is full of them.
Monica Helms was a Navy submariner from 1970 to 1978. She later transitioned and went on to create the transgender pride flag. My colleague Leah Fleming sat down with Helms more recently to learn about the flag and what inspired it.
I was talking to the individual who created the bisexual pride flag, and this was in 1999. And he said, you know, the transgender community could use a flag too. But he gave me one thing that I should remember. keep it simple, because the least amount of stitches, the cheaper it is to make and the cheaper it is to sell. So I thought about it, and then one morning I woke up and I was a little, still waking up and still thinking, and all of a sudden the image came to me, the design came to me. And so I got up and I drew it up and I go, hey, this looks nice. 2 weeks later, I had the original flag in my hands. I did not expect the community to pick it up. I said, well, if people like it, that's great. If they don't like it, well, I have it. It's mine.
You can fly it yourself.
I fly it myself.
Yeah. What does it look like?
5 stripes. Mm-hmm. The outer stripes are light blue, baby blue, which is a traditional color for boys. And the next 2 stripes in are pink for baby girls. And the center stripe is white. And this is for people that are neutral gender. They don't feel that they fall in any kind of binary. And so I took the flag everywhere. Mm-hmm. I went to protests and marches and conferences. I flew it in pride parades. Since I was in the military, I was in the color guard of these pride parades. So I fly it up front. People kept asking, what is it? What is that?
What is it? Yeah.
Yeah. And in 2013... I was looking at pictures of prides across the world, and I started seeing the flag and the colors. My flag. I'm going, what is going on? This is amazing. I'm still amazed at this. I'm still, it floors me. And so I said, oh, gosh, I have the original flag, and I don't want anything to happen to it. So I said, I need to find a place that would take this and keep it safe. And I said, well, might as well start at the top. So I contacted the Smithsonian, and just seems that they were starting an LGBT wing that they wanted to display. And so they were taking in a lot of LGBT items. Mm-hmm. And so the flag was a perfect one to take.
When you look at your flag, what feelings does that evoke for you when you look at it?
Well, I go, well, that's my baby. It's, and of course, when I got to see the flag again, my wife and I went to D.C. last year, mm-hmm. and we went into a back room where they have it stored. They haven't displayed it yet, but the person brought it out that was the one I donated it to, and it was like, seeing my child again. I got to hold my child again.
I'm wondering, why did you feel it was necessary to even create a trans flag? Because I think many people, when they see the rainbow flag, they view that as representing the LGBTQ community.
It's true. And I see the rainbow flag like the American flag. The trans flag and the bisexual flag and all the other flags that have been created since are kind of like state flags that, each state has their own flag, but they're all under the American flag.
That is veteran and transgender activist Monica Helms speaking with GPB Morning Edition host Leah Fleming. Monica's original flag is being kept in the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. You can see pictures at our website, gpbnews.org. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.